Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
The legacy of Pope Francis, the first pope from Latin America and the first Jesuit who named himself after an Italian saint.
There was no pope that picked the name Francis in 800 years of Christianism.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, an outbreak of yellow fever in Colombia is raising concern. Plus, it's tulip season in the Netherlands.
Flowers that are cut yesterday can be in Germany at the end of the afternoon.
We'll take a look at the environmental impact of the global flower trade and a historic meeting for the people in the Caribbean about reparations for the long impact of the transatlantic slave trade.
The issue of reparations is not a fringe discussion, but it is front and center.
All those stories and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Carolyn Beeler is out today. It is a day of mourning for Catholics around the globe after the official announcement from the Vatican early this morning that Pope Francis has died at the age of 88.
La sua vita tutta intera.
Cardinal Kevin Farrell said that the Holy Father, quote, taught us to live the values of the gospel with faithfulness, courage, and universal love, especially for the poorest and most marginalized, end quote. The Vatican said Francis died of a stroke and subsequent heart failure. Just yesterday, though, the pontiff made an Easter appearance for the massive crowd at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buona Pasqua.
Francis wished everyone a happy Easter and then took what would be his last ride in the open-air Popemobile around the square. In his Easter message read out by an archbishop, Pope Francis called for a ceasefire in Gaza and prayed for peace in Yemen and Ukraine. Today, condolences and messages of praise poured in from across the globe. President Trump ordered American flags lowered to half-staff. French President Emmanuel Macron called this a day of deep sorrow.
Il a durant tout son pontificat été aux côtés...
Macron said Francis stood with the most vulnerable, with deep humility and empathy. The World's Matthew Bell starts us off today with a look back at Francis's beginnings and his papal legacy.
Jorge Mario Bergoglio was born in Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina, in December 1936. He was the oldest of five children, and the first thing to know about the Bergoglio family's background is that they were immigrants. Both of Jorge's parents were born in Italy, but he grew up speaking Spanish.
For most of the children of Italians in Argentina, they did not speak the language. The whole idea of the Italians was assimilation.
Gustavo Morello is a Jesuit priest from Argentina and a professor of sociology at Boston College. He says Bergoglio's entire life was shaped by the immigrant experience, which also informed his views on the politics of Argentina, especially with regard to helping the poor.
In Latin America, not just in Argentina, but I would say in Latin America, even if you are, you can be a conservative priest, you can be a progressive priest, but the proximity with the poor is not in discussion. Perhaps the style in which you approach the poor may differ, but the expectation that the Catholic priest should be closer to the people is a very Latin American expectation.
That's your job as a priest?
Yes. Yes, that you have to be there when the people need you.
Poveri bisognosi, non dimentichiamolo mai, sono al cuore del Vangelo.
As a Catholic priest, later as a bishop, and throughout his papacy, Francis emphasized the importance of helping those most in need, and not from afar, but by being close to the poor, the sick, the marginalized. This is probably one reason why Catholic cardinals picked Bergoglio for the papacy. That was after Pope Benedict XVI stepped down in 2013. Gustavo Morello says he was surprised by the choice at the time, No one from Latin America had been pope before. Also, no one from the Jesuit order either, whose priests are known for their work in education and international missions.
There was no pope that picked the name Francis in 800 years of Christianism.
St. Francis of Assisi was a 13th century Italian known for his work with the poor. Morello says Bergoglio was very intentional with that choice.
I think it was very clever in terms of, for a foreigner, picking the name of a very loved Italian saint, but also it's a kind of political program. Like, okay, I want to be closer to the people and the church should be closer to the people.
Soon after becoming pope, for example, Francis visited a juvenile detention center and washed the feet of two women, including a Muslim. He often denounced economic inequality. He also took the Vatican's public relations game to a whole new level.
Son la piel de Judas, prepárese.
In April 2023, Hulu put out a documentary called The Pope Answers. It shows Pope Francis sitting down in conversation with a diverse group of young people, answering questions about the church, faith, sexuality, abortion, all kinds of things. Elise Allen, who writes for the Catholic news site Crux, says Francis embraced the media as a way to get his message out, though he was not the first pope to start using social media.
Benedict actually had opened the Vatican's Twitter account, but that was very soon before his resignation. You know, so Francis is really the first pope we've had in the digital era, which also changes how we see the papacy. It's made the pope's message and the Catholic message much more visible. It's made the church's internal disputes much more visible. So it's, you know, people think this is something new, right? Oh, Francis has brought in maybe some controversy in amongst Catholics, right-wing, left-wing, you know, conservative, progressive. I mean, some of that's always been there. It's just far more visible now because of social media.
Pope Francis took his pastoral role very seriously, says Christiana Zenner. She's an associate professor at the Department of Theology at Fordham University in New York and says that Francis presented aspects of Catholic social teaching to a wider audience, including many non-Catholics. Laudato Si, his encyclical or official teaching on the environment, published in 2015, is a good example of that.
He directed it not just to brothers and sisters in the Catholic Church, as would have been prior tradition, or all people of goodwill, as would have been a more recent tradition in Catholic social teaching. He directed Laudato Si to every person living on this planet.
Zenner points out that Francis was not the first pope to emphasize the importance of protecting the environment as God's creation. John Paul II and Benedict XVI both did that.
But none had centralized the question of environmental degradation, social inequality, consumption, and what it means to be human and what constitutes ethical conduct in the way that Pope Francis does.
Still, Pope Francis was not quite the transformative leader that some had hoped for with regard to the sexual abuse of children by Catholic clergy. Around the world, over many years, Francis is often credited with saying the right things. He's applauded for meeting face-to-face with abuse survivors. But critics say that Francis fell short of holding those responsible to account. On the role of women in the church, some praise Francis for elevating the status of women in certain leadership positions. But Christiana Zenner says Pope Francis had an opportunity to do much more. For example, at a big meeting in 2019 called the Synod on the Amazon, which took place in Rome.
There was a push by many people from the Amazon region to include women in the sacramental life of the church, whether as deacons or as sacramental emissaries of some other sort. And he said no. So women continue to be second-class citizens, sacerdotally, when it comes to performing the sacraments. And that's a line on which the Catholic Church has not been willing to budge in at least a millennia, certainly more.
It's not just progressive Catholics who felt let down by this pope. Francis faced no small amount of resistance from Catholic conservatives, especially here in the United States. John Gehring is the Catholic director at the U.S. nonprofit Faith in Public Life and the author of the book, The Francis Effect.
Pope Francis simply doesn't accept that Catholic identity in politics and public life should be solely defined by opposing abortion and same-sex marriage. You know, in many ways, I think this papacy has been kind of a challenge to those who really try to narrowly define church teaching to affirm a kind of political agenda that often has more in line with, say, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce or the Republican Party than traditional Catholic teaching.
For the American branch of the Catholic Church, which Gehring describes as broadly comfortable and wealthy, the message from Pope Francis was always kind of radical. But Gehring says it was also rooted in the gospel, which is about addressing sin and injustice, even when it makes people uncomfortable. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Stay with The World this week for more on the funeral of Pope Francis and the work to select the next leader of the Catholic Church. An Israeli deputy commander was fired yesterday for his actions in an incident in Gaza that sparked international outrage. Last month, Israeli troops killed 15 Palestinian medics in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. An internal investigation by the Israeli military has now revealed a chain of professional failures by those involved. The Israel Defense Force has blamed poor night visibility for the troops' failure to see the flashing emergency lights on the medics' vehicles. It had previously said the ambulances did not have their lights on at all. That claim was contradicted by cell phone footage recovered from the scene. A rise in cases of yellow fever has prompted a public health emergency in Colombia. Colombia's health ministry reported 34 deaths from nearly 75 cases, a dramatic increase over previous years. Dr. Andrea Vicari is with the Pan American Health Organization in Washington. It's a regional office of the World Health Organization.
So what we are seeing now is what happens usually every 7 to 8 years within the Amazon basin, where you have these cycles of transmission between mosquito and non-human primates. And it happens that you have people that are caught in between in these cycles, and there are sporadic cases. So it's a reflection of really what is going on within the forest.
Doctor, it can be fatal, yellow fever, but remind us of the symptoms. What do people who contract the disease experience?
The infection is only 25% of the people that are bitten by an infected mosquito get infected themselves. So not because you are bitten by a mosquito, suddenly you have the yellow fever. And these around a quarter of the people actually develop quite a specific disease at the beginning, which is what we are seeing in other tropical diseases like dengue, no?
Like dengue, yeah.
Fever, chills, and back pain, and so on. What can happen with yellow fever is that after 4 or 5 years of this relatively mild disease, some people actually develop a very severe disease with affection of many different organs like the liver. And so they can really have quite dire consequences as well.
What are local health officials in Colombia telling people to do right now with this outbreak?
Well, unfortunately, for yellow fever, there is actually a vaccine. The vaccine has been around for many decades now, and it is actually a very effective vaccine in ages up to 60 years, which as well a good safety record. So we do have, you know, in terms of prevention, the vaccine available. And this, I think, is important as well here in North America to know, because it's always a great protection as well for travelers going and traveling worldwide, especially to Latin America and Africa.
Reporting suggests, though, that most of the people who are coming down with yellow fever right now in Colombia are people who have not been vaccinated. So what do you think is going on there?
Yeah, that's typical. I mean, unfortunately, even when a vaccine is available, people, they don't really have access to the vaccination, or they choose not to be vaccinated. So typically, you know, the people, actually the large majority of the cases are typically adults, male adults that actually work in agriculture or do enter within the forest and are exposed to these type of activities.
I mean, it is a dramatic increase in cases this year. You do not seem that surprised, though. Are there any other conditions behind the higher incidence of yellow fever in Colombia this year?
It is a situation where we need to take care. We need to respond. But we are still talking about 75 confirmed cases around. The worry about yellow fever, it's that 75 cases, it will still imply half of them unfortunately dying, and that's an important number as well. It's never really only a question of number, but it's really about the dynamic and how and where is actually yellow fever moving to, that it's a cause of concern.
Dr. Andrea Vicarez with the Pan American Health Organization in Washington. You're listening to The World.
Hey, this is David Rind. I'm an audio producer at CNN. And one of my favorite things about working at CNN is that I can call up our super smart correspondents and reporters whenever I want to pick their brains about the news and the stories they're covering. Well, I want to bring you in on those conversations with our podcast, CNN One Thing. Each week, I grab one of those said reporters and we break down one big story that's been making headlines. Again, the podcast is CNN One Thing. Listen on your favorite podcast app.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Runners from all over the planet race the Boston Marathon today. It's one of the most prestigious marathons in the world. Elite runners clock in sub 5-minute miles for the entire 26.2-mile course. International runners frequently take the podium at Boston, and this year is no different. The World's Jeremy Siegel spoke with us shortly after the winners crossed the finish line.
Hey, Margo, thank you for having me.
So two new Kenyan prize winners this year are the first ones across the line, Sharon Loketi in the women's field and John Carrere, the top finisher in the men's division. How did the race shake out?
Yeah, Sharon Loketi destroyed the women's record this year. It was an incredible race, and she upset the champion from last year, Helen Obiri, who she was neck and neck with right until the end. Sharon Loketi ran a 2 hour and 17 minute and 22 second race, which is 2 minutes faster than the previous record. In the wheelchair race, Marcel Hug of Switzerland has really been unstoppable, and it's no surprise he won again this year. This is his 8th win in Boston, his 3rd in a row. And on the men's side, as you mentioned, Marco, John Carrere of Kenya took home the Boston title for the first time. I spoke to him over the weekend, and his confidence was palpable going in. He talked in terms not of if, but when I win. And he told me that he actually has plans to give a significant portion of his prize money to help children in his home country, Kenya.
In Kenya, many people are poor and are not capable to go to school. So for me, when I raise those money, I will go and pay them school fees and make their life better to go to school and train and become, one day they will become a future runners like me.
So he's going to take that prize money and pay for kids' school fees back in Kenya. With 128 countries, different countries, Jeremy, represented in the race, I wonder if the Trump administration's immigration policies added any complications for runners getting into the country.
Yeah, that was a big question heading into race day. Usually it's just a matter of filling out some forms and waiting on your visa if you need one if you're a runner. Obviously, with the Trump administration's crackdown on some travelers entering the U.S., there's an added layer here this year. There have been headlines of people detained at airports in recent weeks, the Trump administration reportedly considering a travel ban on dozens of countries, and roughly half of them are in Africa. And athletes from Africa make up a large portion of the elite field. But for the elite competitors, the Boston Athletic Association, which oversees the race, says there were no problems. They facilitated visas for travelers from African countries who needed them. They provided an official invitation in visa applications. And John Carrere, who won, he told me that he had no problems whatsoever getting into the U.S.
What about the tens of thousands of amateur runners? What was their experience traveling to Boston, and how do they feel about being here given some of the souring international opinions of the U.S.?
Yeah, I chatted with runners from all around the world, including Brazil, Japan, Europe, and everyone told me they had no qualms about traveling to the U.S. for the race and no trouble getting into the country. Ken Toe of London has actually done all of the 5 other major world marathons. So with Boston today, he's completed all of them. And before the race, he described to me what it was like for him after getting off the plane in Boston.
I came with my wife and just got asked about immigration. Why are you here for the marathon? All right, amazing. Congratulations. Off you go.
Off you go. Now, Marco, I can't speak for the entire field of runners today, but the experience that Ken described is basically representative of everyone I spoke to.
That's The World's Jeremy Siegel, our transportation correspondent. A reminder that the sport of running is still about getting from point A to point B. Jeremy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco.
A court in Tunisia handed down prison sentences in a mass trial this weekend. The defendants, critics of the government. Their prison sentences range between 13 and 66 years. Opponents of President Kais Saied say the trial shows Tunisia's backslide from democracy. Tarek Megharissi is following the latest. He's with the European Council on Foreign Relations based in the UK.
The charges themselves are kind of farcical because they are being charged as kind of terrorists and of traitors to the state. And it's quite an eclectic mix of people rather than any one particular union or group. I mean, you have the former central bank governor whose explanation of why he's being charged for terrorism and for undermining the state was simply a made-up conspiracy theory with no actual fact behind it. You have the two people who formed the political front against him in the past elections. You have a human rights defender who criticized the president's treatment of migrants. You even have, you know, simple a policy fellow, a Tunisian who is like me, who works for the Carnegie Endowment, who was tried in absentia. So all of these collection of people are being charged now as terrorists, are being sentenced as terrorists. And as you said in your introduction, some really horrifically long sentences.
So what is the charge they were laid with regarding terrorism?
Well, each one has kind of a different charge put against him. Some of them are quite murky because the procedure itself, in the words of one of the defense lawyers, Ahmed Soab, was farcical. So sometimes our lawyers didn't get the right papers. They're not even sure what the actual sentence is for some of them. But they were tried in the kind of military court system, and they were tried under either attacks against the state. But really, the charges themselves are immaterial. These are show trials being done by the president to distract from the increasingly poor economic situation and, of course, to get rid of any opposition. And I mean, there's no clearer sign of that than the fact that one of these defense lawyers, the guy who I just mentioned, was actually arrested today for calling these trials a farce.
Well, we know that Kais Saied, the president, has been chipping away at Tunisia's democratic institutions for several years now. What do the trial itself and the sentences coming out of it tell us about the democratic future of Tunisia?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, it's just another nail in the coffin of Tunisia's democracy, especially considering the fact that so many of these people were only under trial because they tried to do that very democratic thing of running in an election or challenging the lack of fairness or freedom in previous elections. Unfortunately, you know, this is just one more right that is being taken away from Tunisians over the past few years. You've had the right to assembly, the right to choose their leaders, their own constitution all changed, and now you have this right to a fair trial also being taken away from them.
So if this trial of critics happened, Tarek, do you see more trials like this coming?
Yeah, I think that this is kind of inevitable. I mean, if you take the perspective that a great motivator of these trials is firstly to get rid of any criticism, but then secondly to distract from the economic health or the political economy of the country, then okay, perhaps now fewer people will be inclined to speak out, even though those who have fled the country will continue to do so. But given the country continues to decline on every political economy measure, then unfortunately, it seems like it's almost an inevitability that he will continue to double down on this distraction technique. And as we were talking about at the beginning of the interview, a lot of the commentary around the charges are that, you know, these are the elites of Tunisia, and they are the ones who are to blame for Tunisia's state of disrepair. It's not the president's fault. It's these guys who are all in conspiracy. And so it seems almost inevitable, sadly, that he's going to keep doubling down on these conspiracy charges and try to shift the blame from his own administration.
Tarek Megharissi is with the European Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Spring is springing in the Northern Hemisphere, greeting us with the first green sprouts of bulbs. If you can't wait for the irises to pop, you've got lilies, roses, and tulips at your local grocery and florist. Cut flowers for sale around the world all have to come from somewhere. Most often they arrive on a plane from fields and greenhouses far away from their destinations. Our partners at the Deutsche Welle podcast Living Planet set out to examine the environmental impact of the global trade in cut flowers. Reporter Kathleen Schuster begins a story in the town of Aalsmeer in the Netherlands. That's where Michel van Sree of Royal Flora Holland gets up at the crack of dawn.
It starts at 6,
and it goes until all the flowers are sold.
We're inside the largest flower market in the world. Drivers on little forklifts sip through a labyrinth of refrigerated flowers in this warehouse which extends farther than the eye can see. This is Royal Flora Holland.
And the auctioneer is specialized in a typical product. So he is specialized in roses. He knows the market, he knows who the buyers are, he knows what the prices were the day before and what he can expect.
And despite it being the least busy day of their week, a Thursday, this place is bustling. If you've had the good fortune of flying through Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport in the spring, you may have seen the purple, red, and yellow fields of tulips out the window. They blanket more than 60,000 acres of the country. That's an area twice the size of Paris. Tourists from all over the world come to see these classic symbols of Dutch culture, including the ones you can hear behind us perusing tulip-themed trinkets in the Royal Flora Holland gift shop. Not even including the tourist influx attracted by tulip mania each year, tulips generate more than $2 billion for the Netherlands, mainly in the form of exported tulip bulbs shipped around the world to be grown elsewhere. But the Netherlands are more than just tulips. This country is a hub for the world's flower industry, making it the top exporter of cut flowers globally. We're just a 10-minute drive from Amsterdam's international airport, making it convenient for flowers from the Netherlands, but also from France and Kenya and Ethiopia to be shipped to Royal Flora Holland. They're then sold and shipped to buyers around Europe and even as far as the United States and Japan. 20 million flowers a day.
So that's quite a lot.
A lot indeed. The Netherlands' position in Europe, both logistically with one of the world's major airports and in terms of its floral history, is what makes it so central to the flower market.
The first auction was founded in Aalsmeer in 1911. It started in a pub where the growers placed their products on the billiard.
That's Michel van Schie again, spokesperson for Royal Flora Holland and our guide through this famous and rather old flower auction. So before 1911, flower buyers had been sneaking around and taking advantage of the growers.
And they were going to all the growers in the neighborhood and they told the grower, your neighbor sells the product for a lower price.
Growers quickly caught on though, and they decided to form an auction to sell all of their flowers together. Michel says this helped usher in transparency to the market, so soon every village had one. Over time, they merged together into bigger and bigger flower auctions. In 2008, the two largest ones became Flora Holland, and in 2011, they got to add the word royal to their name.
Royal, because you can only be royal when you're more than 100 years old.
Today, over 2,000 cooperative members, the flower growers, sell their products at Royal Flora Holland. About a quarter of those are sellers from abroad, and each weekday, 2,500 buyers bid on their products, from Dutch tulips to Kenyan roses.
So now everything is done by remote buying. And over here you can see how the clock works.
There's an auction clock that counts down from 60 seconds, following the announcement of each particular flower. Let's say this clock is for Easter lilies. The clock begins at the highest price for that batch of Easter lilies, and as it counts down, the price too goes down. So buyers have to press a button at the time and price they're willing to pay for those Easter lilies. Press too late, and the Easter lilies might already have been bought up by somebody else. Press too soon, and the buyer will be paying an extra cent more.
And you say 1 cent, it's not that much. But when you buy millions of products in a year, and you pay for every stem 1 cent extra, it's quite a lot of money. So that's the game they have to play.
Once the flowers are sold, they're taken out of cool storage and drivers pick them up.
This is a system which brings the trolleys to the other side of the road where the main buyers are located. And this system is in total 15 kilometers long.
It's a massive operation of tiny forklifts zipping around, transporting those hypothetical Easter lilies to us in floral shops and grocery stores.
So flowers that are cut yesterday, brought here during the night, can be in Germany at the end of the afternoon.
When the buyers are deciding on which varieties they'd like to buy each day, there's one more thing they can see on the auction clocks as well.
They can see what are the sustainability certificates a grower has. And it's for the benefit of the whole flower industry that we'd be as transparent as possible about the way the products are produced. And, of course, there are many different aspects when you are talking about sustainability.
Yes, that's for sure. When I hear this, I can't help but think of my own local grocery store. The first thing I see when I walk in are bouquets of delicate pink roses, bright yellow sunflowers, and my personal favorite, peach-colored tulips. And they all cost just a couple of euros. But all of those euros add up to a $34 billion cut flower industry. An industry that's, as you might have guessed, heavily reliant on water and pesticides, and air travel too, because flowers are one of the very few things we ship by plane. And that's not even the biggest concern when it comes to their greenhouse gas emissions. Really, when it comes down to it, store-bought flowers aren't a necessity, but there's something else that's become essential in their own way.
Because flowers and plants give people happiness and also well-being.
After all, flowers are how we show our love and appreciation. They show someone we're thinking about them on their birthday or Mother's Day or someday when they could use a pick-me-up. Flowers are one of the only gifts that feel appropriate when someone's sick or healing or grieving. Flowers connect us to the seasons, tulips in April, peonies in June. They bring a little beauty to tables at local cafes and hallways and hotels. Should we give up these blooms that are beautiful but not essential because of their environmental footprint? Or can we do something about it? While nearly everything we buy these days travels by container ships, an option that's cheap and relatively slow, cut flowers are one of the few goods that go bad so quickly they need to be sent on a plane. For each extra day a flower has to travel, it loses 15% of its value. But air freight generates 47 times as much emissions as a container ship. In fact, for consumers in the UK, a bouquet of imported flowers had a more significant impact than an 8-ounce steak from deforested land in the Brazilian Amazon. And lots of flowers today are imported. Colombia and Ecuador account for many flowers sold in the US, and Europe mainly imports from Ethiopia and Kenya.
Tambuzi is a medium-scale flower farm that started way back in 1996. It's located at the equator, base of Mount Kenya. My name is Christine Shikuku, and it's been over two decades now that I've been involved with Tambuzi.
At Tambuzi, where Kristen's the general manager, they mainly grow roses, and those roses supply weddings and events all over the world.
We mainly sell across 5 continents in the world, mainly Europe, Asia, Australia, Africa, and recently North America.
While it might seem easy from an environmental perspective to say, just don't buy imported flowers, Kristen says this industry has massively impacted her community.
The main farm for Tambuzi is located in a community called Bagoret. It's quite in the rural Kenya. And Tambuzi is the major employer. We have more than 75% of our 251 employees who work in this main farm come from this very community.
She says it's an open farm, no electric fences, transparent policies only. They also work together closely with local leaders on how to strengthen the community.
Like, for example, recently we had our big client support us to buy water storage tanks for our employees. They take it home. And who benefits? It's not just the Tambuzi employee, it's the family. And some of them even opened it up to their neighbors. So the community indirectly benefits from Tambuzi.
They've also helped build a medical lab close by and helped fund a wide array of programs aimed at helping kids thrive in school and sports. After tea, flowers, especially roses, had become Kenya's second largest export and one of its largest sources of employment, providing 200,000 jobs directly and supporting an additional 2 million indirectly. Pressures on the industry have also pushed Kenyan growers to adopt more sustainable practices. For Tambuzi, that started with water.
20 years ago, the floriculture was such in the limelight. There was negative publicity because of the things that were happening. And so the communities around flower farms would go up in arms and say, you're taking all the water. All these challenges made the floriculture industry be innovative so that they carry out good practices to be able to be sustainable in the communities they're carrying out the business.
For example,
we do harvest rainwater from our greenhouse roofs, store them in lagoons that we built, and then irrigate from there. In fact, we do not do direct abstraction from the river Bagoret. The river crosses through our farm, and we made a deliberate decision 15 years ago never ever to abstract directly from the river. We recycle treated wastewater. We use constructed wetlands to treat our wastewater, and then recycle back for irrigation.
When it comes to carbon emissions, the footprint of each rose is still high because they're flown to their destinations. In fact, Kenya exports so many flowers that Nairobi's Jomo Kenyatta International Airport has a dedicated flower terminal for flights full of flowers headed to places like Germany, the UK, the Middle East, and of course, the Netherlands. Kristen, who's responsible for Tambuzi's various certifications, says the farm has been offsetting its carbon footprint by using solar energy and tree planting. But flights aren't the only environmental concern here. Back in Europe, the other big source of greenhouse gas emissions from the flower industry come from, well, greenhouses.
The heating provided to the cut flowers to develop, that is quite substantial, especially in Dutch condition, to force the bulbs to flower.
Northern Europe is not a place that can support year-round cultivation without heated and well-lit greenhouses. This heat is supplied primarily by fossil fuels like methane gas and coal, and to a lesser but growing extent, renewable energy like wind and solar. There aren't many people who've studied the environmental impacts of the flower industry, but we did manage to find one.
Oh, yes, yes. I have a particular interest in cut flower, generally speaking. I have them at home. I always used to cultivate a small orchard with some roses, some tulips, some narcissus. My name is Pietro Goglio, and I'm senior researcher at the Department of Agriculture, Food and Environmental Science at the University of Perugia.
Pietro has studied floriculture practices in the Netherlands, and he says there are two big environmental problems with the industry: pesticides and greenhouse gas emissions, as we've been discussing. The emissions from actual greenhouses make a particularly big difference.
And therefore, if we are producing roses during wintertime, they have different impact, at least in Europe, than the same product during summertime, you know, just for the simple reason of seasonality.
Heating greenhouses doesn't just contribute to emissions. It can also be expensive for farmers. In fact, this was actually the drive behind flower production shifting to warmer climates, like in Kenya in the 1970s, when an oil crisis forced many U.S. and European greenhouses to close up shop. Growers in Israel and Morocco, East Africa, and Latin America filled the gap. Farms like Tambuzi don't need to heat their greenhouses. Surprisingly, this move to warmer and further climates wasn't the worst outcome when it comes to climate-changing greenhouse gas emissions. Multiple studies have found that the emissions from transporting Kenyan flowers to Europe by air, while huge, are actually lower than those emitted by heated Dutch greenhouses.
So there is a trade-off, I would say, between these two aspects.
Certainly, renewable energy sources could change this, And the Dutch government and its horticulture sector have agreed to reduce emissions from greenhouses.
For sure, energy cost is going to be a drive for increasing the efficiency of the systems. And this is something that could make by itself the system more sustainable.
Sometimes we have to adapt, and we must not forget about what the importance is of this industry, not only for the Netherlands.
Back at Royal Flora Holland, Michel agrees that there are things the flower industry can do better. And institutions like Royal Flora Holland are raising their standards. Michel tells us their management board recently decided that all of their growers must be FSI certified, that's Floriculture Sustainability Initiative, by 2027. But how are consumers supposed to keep all of this straight?
Of course, a florist knows where the flowers are coming from. So he can make that claim for sure when he buys it himself. He knows it because it's on the clock. And we are heading to a system with it's Flora PECR, if I say it correctly, where the footprint of a flower will be on stem level. So then you know what is the footprint of a bouquet.
QR codes for chrysanthemums and carnations. That's the idea. In some ways, it harkens back to the flower auction's founding as a way to offer transparency and create a level playing field among growers.
That's reporter Kathleen Schuster from our partners at the Deutsche Welle podcast, Living Planet. Coming up, a new UN effort to atone for the transatlantic slave trade. Also ahead, classical conductor Gustavo Dudamel plus pop power equals an amazing weekend at Coachella. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. An extraordinary meeting took place last week at the United Nations. The descendants of enslaved people and the descendants of slave owners met to discuss reparations. 30 million people from Africa were forced into slavery in the Americas during the transatlantic slave trade. The session at the UN focused on former British colonies in the Caribbean and included Arley Gill. He chairs Grenada's National Reparations Commission. Gill spoke with us today from St. George's, the capital of Grenada.
To meet in the United Nations Forum, it was a very touching moment. It was refreshing in a sense, because here we have descendants of the persons who enslaved the Africans, and you had descendants of the Africans who were enslaved. We believe that work together goes some way in building bridges, in healing the damages and so on, which was caused by the Atlantic slave trade and slavery.
What did these personal touches bring that was different to the current discussion around reparations?
Well, if you ask us whether or not 15, 20 years ago we would have had that discussion, we may have laughed at you. To have these persons coming forward and say, listen, we are prepared to apologize. Tell us what we can do to repair the harm which was done by our ancestors. And we hope that this, in a sense, would be able to mount additional pressure on the governments and institutions like the Bank of England and so on, who would have profited and benefited from these crimes against humanity.
Arley, can you just give us kind of the impact the slave trade had on Grenada?
It has left its trail of underdevelopment in our island. In 1974, when Grenada received its independence from the United Kingdom, the United Kingdom did not leave $1 in our treasury for us to build infrastructure and to improve roads and to improve our health and education systems and so on. We had to, from the very first day of our independence, borrow monies to pay our public servants and for our infrastructure. So that you'll find that a society or country like Grenada is heavily indebted to international institutions. The legacy of the Atlantic slave trade and slavery, what it has left in Grenada and the rest of the Caribbean, has been massive underdevelopment of our societies.
Well, you represent Grenada's Reparations Commission. What is Grenada seeking in terms of reparations?
So Grenada is not on its own. We are guided by the CARICOM Reparations Commission 10-point plan. Let me make that absolutely clear. And we are not just seeking money. The first thing on that plan is an apology. That's the first thing. It's an apology. Then we go through the plan and we are seeking funding for education, for health, for debt forgiveness, for transfer of technology, for repatriation of those of us who may want to return to Africa and so on, because you would appreciate that the Atlantic slave trade resulted in millions of displacement of Africans. So that is what we're seeking. We're not just seeking a blank check. The 10-point CARICOM plan, which Grenada submits to, is a development plan.
Right. So that's the kind of the outline of the 10-point CARICOM plan that you're following. Let me just ask you about the apology, first of all, because individual descendants of slave owners have publicly apologized to Grenada and other Caribbean countries for their families' involvement. Some have also donated money. How do people in Grenada feel about these kinds of acknowledgments?
It's welcomed, highly welcomed. These families are saying to us, we accept that what our ancestor did was wrong. And we ask for your forgiveness, and then we make a commitment that it will never happen again. We see this as extremely important because so far what we've had from British prime ministers and the monarchy and so on is words with regards to regret that this has happened and so on and so forth. And so too, we see that as critically important that the Europeans who profited from the Atlantic slave trade, slavery, and indigenous genocide, the very first thing they must do is to admit that these crimes against humanity was wrong and that they ask for forgiveness. We believe that that's an extremely important first step in healing the wounds which was caused by these crimes of humanity.
So what are the next steps after this meeting at the UN?
We continue our advocacy. We continue our engagement with stakeholders, with the families, with institutions. So we continue to lobby institutions and governments and so on regards to reparative justice. The struggle continues.
That's Arley Gill. He chairs Grenada's National Reparations Commission. The Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival wrapped up over the weekend. A roster of regulars were featured. Lady Gaga, of course, along with Post Malone, and nostalgia acts like German electronica innovators Kraftwerk. There was one big surprise, a genre that has never appeared at Coachella.
What is the most important thing is, you know, breaking these walls, you know, between music styles and making, you know, these kind of bridges between all cultures. And this is the most wonderful thing to be here.
That's Venezuelan conductor of the L.A. Philharmonic, Gustavo Dudamel, speaking with, yes, K-Rock, the Los Angeles alternative rock station, prior to Saturday's performance at Coachella.
Of course, bring the great music of Beethoven, of Wagner, of Vivaldi, of Strauss, but at the same time, bring the wonderful music of these wonderful artists that we are working together, and bringing that all together, it makes, you know, a beautiful symbol as a great embracing moment for all of us.
Wagner, along with guest performances by the likes of Dave Grohl of Foo Fighters and Cynthia Erivo, doing a near operatic cover of Prince's Purple Rain with the LA Phil. Lee Ann Hahn has booked global artists in venues large and small in Southern California for over 30 years. She was at Coachella on Saturday for the performance by the LA Phil.
What Dudamel did was he created a contemporary mixtape of classical chestnuts that we all know and love. The genius of what Dudamel and the Phil did was they brought together musicians from around the world to play music that we know that means something to us, whether we are members of a polyglot community or whether we are looking for the best punk rock music we can.
It's such an honor to be here.
It was thrilling for Icelandic singer Leve to join the LA Phil under the baton of Dudamel. She released her song Silver Lining only a week ago, and Saturday she got to perform it live for the first time at Coachella with what the New York Times has called the most important orchestra in America.
I've been falling in that habit, staring into the abyss.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
We've been kissing all day, acting like little kids.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.